The grass loincloth was surprisingly thick. I had been told that layer after layer of grass is constantly added from childhood on, till by its wearer's manhood it consists of hundreds of layers and maybe several inches thick. The pipe was passed. I asked for a smoke. They shared it, reluctantly. Evidently, tobacco was a commodity in short supply. They indicated it would make me sick. I took a tentative puff, then a bigger one. They underestimated me. The tobacco was not strong at all. In fact, it was pleasant. I passed it on. It was not passed back to me. So I went and dug in my pack and produced two cigars. I offered one to the man who spoke pidgin, the one in the funny hat. Ah, thank you, Wontok. Wontok means very good friend. He smoked this, passed it around. Excellent tobacco. I smoked the other. A child came in with a tin pot full of cherry tomatoes. It was offered to me. Ah, thank you. How much? Nothing, nothing. The man in the black shirt affected indignation. It is free. He was sorry they were so small, but all the bigger ones had been eaten. The tomatoes were small and red and glistening with water, for they had been washed in the stream. I got out a salt shaker and proceeded to eat. Ah, sweet. Yes, sweet. Too much. Thank you, true, Wontok. I ate nearly the whole bunch. The afternoon passed in a lazy haze. Sitton got up and came in. He was not eager to talk business tonight with the villagers, save it for tomorrow. I went out, walked around, found myself dizzy with fatigue after a few steps. The sky all around was gray and cloudy. The village and airstrip sat on a ridge, bounded on each side by deep ravines. A few huts were scattered around the airstrip, set in the middle of cow-cow gardens. Back the way we had come was the bristling wall of jungle. Across the ravine on the other side were more huts and pawpaw trees. Apparently there was a ravine beyond them, too. Beyond that ravine were truly big mountains, Dreapella indeed, much higher than we were here, higher evidently than anything we had crossed. They were matted with jungle, lying in an escarpment wall to the southwest. We would have to cross them to get to Aiwamba. I hung wet clothes out to dry and went back in the hut. They were still smoking and talking. As the afternoon wore on, women brought offerings of food, billums full of cow-cow and cooking bananas. The boys cooked the food for supper as a crowd gathered in the hut. We ate, talked, looked, listened, let people touch us and marvel at us. As outside it grew dark, night set in, the fire glowed and glistened in eyes dark and wide with wonder. One boy of about 12 sat beside me, holding my arm, alternately kissing, sniffing, even licking it. His eyes were mesmerized with fascination. I watched him from the corner of my eye. He was not aware of my gaze, only of my arm, which, miracle of miracles, he was able to hold and sample like something his very own. At last he looked up at me, and his eyes were wide open and smiling and brilliant with wonder. Later, our group burrowed into sleeping bags in the back room and slept deeply in the cool mountain night. By next morning, little had changed. Soon after I got up, the man with the black shirt and several boys came into the front room and sat around the fire pit. The schoolboys were up, piddling with their possessions, kindling a fire to cook a breakfast, cow-cow. When the fire was going good, I put a pot of water on to boil so I could make coffee. Yes, coffee would be good here, now, at last. The man in the black shirt with the crumpled hat spoke pidgin, it is true, but his pidgin was a far cry from the pidgin heard in towns like Lei. Perhaps he spoke it with a Minyamya accent. It was very guttural, with long, drawn-out syllables, followed by rapid spurts, so I had a hard time following it. We chatted as the coffee steeped. Then I poured in the cold water to settle the grounds. It was a pot full of good, strong New Guinea Highland coffee, The aroma was rich in the cool mountain morning inside the smoky hut. I poured myself a cup and offered some to the man. Yes, he would have some. He sent one of the youngsters for a cup. It was a white enamel cup specked with dirt and cobwebs. He wiped it with his shirt tail, and I poured him a mug full. Some others accepted tentative half cupfuls. Perhaps they knew what it was, perhaps not. But this fellow, who for the time being was the only adult male here, drank it as nonchalantly as though he drank coffee every morning. Soon the old man, Mazwara, still wearing his torn purple sweater, came in. He was carrying a mambu, for he was a passionate lover of tobacco. It seemed to be his chief vice. The tobacco he rolled and put in his pipe was light brown, and, for all I knew, might not have been tobacco at all. Perhaps it was some weed they grew for a substitute. Now I decided was the time to open trading. I went to my pack and got several cigars, then brought them casually into the front room. Now, what did I see that I wanted? Well, the fellow with the black shirt had around his neck a pair of bamboo jew's harps, tied together by a bark string. I asked him to let me look at them. He did so. I examined them carefully. I asked, could he play them? Of course. He took them and blew on one, plucking it. Twong, twong. All right, I would give him a cigar for the Jew's harps. Okay, sure. This was not something Bailong Tumbuna. That is something of great value made by the ancestors or in the tradition of the ancestors. He could make these any time. They were nothing. We traded. He took the cigar. I hung the Jew's harps around my neck. Now I looked at old Mazwara. He was smoking away on the mambu, apparently oblivious to our trading. I spoke to him. Papa, I will give you two cigars for your pipe. Oh, but the pipe was not his. It belonged to the man in the black shirt, and the man in the black shirt said the pipe was something Bailong Tumbuna. He would not sell it, certainly not for two cigars, maybe for three kina. But no, three kina was too much for a mambu I really didn't care about owning anyway. I drummed my fingers. What about a bow and arrows? Did he own any? Certainly. May I see them? He snapped his fingers at a boy, telling him to bring his bow and arrows. Soon I held them in my hands. Black palm bow, pit-pit string. Several reed arrows with various points. Points for killing pigs and points for killing birds. The points for pigs were long, straight, sharp, ice-pick-like, hardwood points, apparently charred in the fire. For birds, there was a reed split into sections so that it fanned out into four or five points. And then there was an arrow with a heavy, solid, round chunk of flattened wood at the end for killing birds and small game. Very good, but would it shoot? Yes, of course it would shoot. What would he take for the bow and arrows? Two kina for them all. All right, two kina it was. Now he must demonstrate shooting them for me. Gladly. We went outside into the brilliant sunshine. Sitton was up now, and he came out too, as did all the schoolboys and a number of villagers. Do you have a target, something you can shoot the arrow into, a banana tree, maybe? I asked. No, that made no sense. Here, watch. He aimed out across the airstrip, jerked the string back suddenly, and released an arrow. It soared over the field and disappeared in the weeds. Now, what did I think of that? Very good. May I try? He had drawn the string with the end of the arrow clamped between his thumb and forefinger. I used three fingers. I drew the bow tentatively, not as easily as he had, and released an arrow. It too soared across the field. Ah, very good. A boy was sent to retrieve the arrows. Now I asked the man, suppose a bird sat on a limb, could you shoot it off? He looked at me scornfully. You think what? Of course. The arrows were brought back. They had penetrated perhaps 8 inches into the soil. Remarkable indeed. And now back to the hut to sit and smoke. In the hut, hanging from smoke-blackened rafters, was a huge gourd horn, fashioned after the manner of a hunting horn. I took it down and examined it. Could anyone here blow it? Of course. One of the schoolboys took it and puffed into the spout, which was a tube of soft wood inserted in the narrow end of the dark brown gourd. He blew. It moaned like a foghorn, like the Loch Ness Monster. This was the horn used to summon villagers for meetings, particularly church, they said. I expressed interest in buying the horn. Could it be bought? Oh, sure. It had little value. In fact, they had another one. A boy fetched it. It was similar, but had no blowpipe. Instead, a hole had been cut in the side of the narrow end of the gourd and was blown in the same manner as the other. I was dealing with old Funny Hat, now old Black Shirt. I know not what made him the owner of the horns, but it was he who would take my money, a cigar and 30 toya, a toya equaling 1.5 American cents, would buy either one. I could take my pick. I chose the one with the stem. Thus I began my trading venture, which was to affect our relations with these people, at least so it seemed to me later. In any event, the next batch of food brought into the hut was for sale. The night before, old Blackshirt had virtually pitched a fit when we offered money for food. Now, he glibly set prices on food brought in. Pawpaws, bananas, cow-cow, all appeared, and all had price tags. For now, it was evident that we had wealth and were willing to part with it. We had no complaints with the new system. We did not want to live off these people, giving them nothing in return. Before we left Lei, Sitten and I each had converted about 15 kenya into small change for the purposes of buying food and hiring carriers. So our 5, 10, and 20 toya pieces began slipping away as we supplied ourselves and our boys with great batches of food. The weather stayed gray and drizzly, with clouds sometimes parting suddenly to reveal sunlight. The sky in these mountains was always changing. Clouds boiled up from ravines below us, obscured mountains, made great images in the sky, and drifted away in herds. Sunlight danced and played on the clouds like fingers on a fat harp. It was Possum Sua time. Everyone come for Possum Sua. We got out the heavy first aid box. Sitten was no Possum Sua man, but I had done some in Lei, and besides had a strong background in public health and first aid. The boys had been trained in basics at school. Possum Sua was an elementary mission duty. The natives swarmed to us, many children, mothers, grandmothers, a few men. We had pills for adults, pills for children. Skin ulcers were common. In hot, humid, coastal areas like Lei, skin ulcers are the universal ailment. Everybody has them. Some have scores of them running up and down their legs. They start as scratches or insect bites and in humid, unsanitary conditions grow into weeping infected sores. Left alone, they might heal or they might fester. We had a variety of ointments, powders, and simple antiseptics for sores, depending on their severity. Then there were a few ear infections, little bawling kids with ears full of pus. Swab it gently, pour in the medicine. Mama soothes youngster. Even this far back in the bush, natives appear to be great believers in medicine. The clean white bandages might last scarcely an hour on their dirty legs. They might listen idly to advice about washing sores and eating greens for vitamins, but they flock to Possum Sua anyway. Eye infections were the going thing in Angati. They were to Angati villages what tropical ulcers were to coastal natives, only they weren't as severe. Most, with one or two exceptions among children, were slight infections. Ointment was squeezed from a tube and applied under the eyelid. Very good, except to the children, petrified and howling with terror, especially those who had truly bad infections in the eyes. Maybe it was the many flies in Engatti that spread infection. Flies were the bane of Engatti. If you sat on a mountainside to contemplate the whirl of land and sky, your hands were occupied swatting at flies. Flies without end, biting flies, flies which would as soon walk across your eyeball as your arm, flies which leave you and feast upon the hidden piles of feces in the jungle. They're refreshed. They come back for a look-see. Natives pay them no mind. So when a fly, its feet caked in excrement, strolls around their eyes, they scarcely blink. Yet I enjoyed possum sua, a skin ulcer. First, it must be cleansed with disinfectant in a cotton ball. If it's slight, without pus, apply some blue antiseptic. If it had pus, apply ointment and bandage. If especially bad, open and weeping, apply sulfur powder and tight bandage. For such treatment, the natives line up. Tough bucks, holding bush knives and wearing bones in their noses, stick their legs up on the log which serves as a stool. They point here and here and this one and here, here and here. Then there are the colds, snuffy noses, coughs. A medicine called cuss is downed. I expressed surprise to a missionary in Lehi that colds, for which nothing helps in the United States, are so confidently treated in New Guinea. Smiling, she advised me that the cure for the common cold had in fact been discovered and was embodied in the murky brown syrup, mysteriously known as cuss. Natives may spurn you and your teachings, but they come to possum sua. Mothers like it especially for their children. Attention, relief, however temporary, from plaguing ailments. They are a people without aspirin, Alka-Seltzer, cold capsules, nose spray, cough syrup, iodine, even rubbing alcohol. Soap and washing are foreign. Headaches are endured or treated with stinging nettle. As a cure, these leaves are applied to the forehead. They sting so horribly that the patient forgets the headache. Voila! Malaria's ravages go unchecked. Babies die. Men, women, and children occasionally succumb to skin hot. Sores follow their natural course. If a person has a tough constitution and other circumstances are favorable, the sores may heal of their own accord, leaving only scars, or they may fester till a foot swells up like a yellow football and begins to stink of gangrene. They have none of our drugs in the bush. They don't have tranquilizers to soothe their tensions and help them sleep. But they have buai. Buai, betel nut, which, say some missionaries, boogers up the temple of the Holy Spirit, the human body. Buai, a native told me, soothes pain, warms a cold person, induces sleep in restless people, and is a general palliative for what ails ye. A native, joints achy, muscles sore, sleep refusing to come, will reach for buai like an American church elder, will get up in the middle of the night and go to his medicine chest for aspirin, antacid, ointment, tranquilizer, decongestant, or any of a myriad other drugs. Buai also rots teeth and is believed to cause cancer. It dulls the senses and may make hot tempers prone to violence. It is said to be addictive. Its ambivalent role poses a thorny problem. In Engatti, these natives were not worried. Their cheeks, even as they lined up for possum sua, were swollen with double nuggets of ruby red. Now it was time to get down to business. Lotu Church. It was late afternoon, our second and last day here in Engatti. It was not Sunday, granted, but Sitton wanted to hold Lotu. He would preach, and Alice, as agreed, would translate. From the hut, we got one of the big gourd horns, and a boy blew it. It sounded out across the valleys and ravines in a dinosaur wail. The few people in the immediate area around these huts gathered in the open space, sitting, chatting, laughing. Old Blackshirt was there, and Mauswara, and a host of women with breasts a flat as shoe soles, plus one or two girls in their prime, maybe 12, 13, even 14, with round, pointed little breasts and lithe forms, who would have been really quite striking had they been taught the basics of cleanliness. All of them, men, women, and children, had protruding cow-cow bellies, bulging under their chests like basketballs, the result of a virtually meatless diet of worms and perhaps of malaria's swollen spleen. Squatting and sitting, they chewed buai, occasionally spitting red gobs over the short cane picket fence into the garden. A few natives from surrounding huts drifted over, and Gati apparently consisted of huts scattered out in these mountains as far off as perhaps a half mile. We seemed to be at the hub. So a few drifted in, and at last Sitton began the service. He started by letting Peterson say a prayer to Papa God. After that, I got out Sitton's movie camera to film the first 3 minutes, which seemed the typical beginning to a village lotu. But what came after those first 3 minutes was not recorded on film. It was the beginning of a breakdown, the early tremors of a veritable earthquake in our relations with these people. And it came simply when Sitton, having spoken a few words on the kingdom of God, asked Alice to translate. But Alice, grinning sheepishly, scarcely knew a word of pidgin. He could not translate the sermon from pidgin to the native tongue. He barely understood Sitton's request to translate. His knowledge of pidgin just failed him somehow. Poor fellow. Perhaps, posited Sitton, it was the use of the word kingdom that threw Alice into such a tizzy. After all, the concept of kingdom belongs to a foreign culture. There are no kings in New Guinea. So he rephrased it, the big village of God. But no, Alice was lost, incoherent, bewildered, and our lotu was at a standstill. The dozen or so adults were growing slightly restless. How about old Blackshirt, with whom we had done so much trading? He spoke pidgin fluently. Would he translate? No, no. He, too, was sheepish. No, why not? What possible reason could he have for refusing? He certainly couldn't deny his fluency in pidgin. He had babbled to us for hours in it. But no, he could not translate our sermon. Why? Because he was a Lutheran. Lutheran. The spider web of interdenominational rivalry reached even here, spreading its inhospitality into the hearts of men who scarcely knew the rudiments of Christian faith. Somewhere, somehow, probably in Lehi, this fellow had listened to Lutheran preachers, hung around their mission, received their gifts, became converted, perhaps, picked up the idea that one never helps a preacher of another faith dispense his teaching. It was an old story in Papua New Guinea. At this, Sitton's eyes blazed, then shuttered. All right. No one will translate. We cannot have Lotu. That's it. He walked to our hut and climbed in. The audience was left quite bewildered. Most of them, not understanding pidgin, could sense the currents of obstinacy and growing anger, but perhaps did not know just what caused them. Or maybe they did. Chapter 7. Stuck. This called for a powwow, for some stern talking, but not yet. Sitton in the back room had stretched out on his sleeping bag to sleep. He could be exquisitely stubborn, if stubborn was the word. Perhaps that was a trait born of long contact with bush natives, where big words and promises are much spouted but little adhered to. But this was a hard blow. 6 days into the jungle to find our translator wouldn't translate, and the one villager who is capable of translating refuses on religious grounds. That night, a group of men collected in the hut as usual to talk and smoke. We sat around the fire. Outside, it was windy, threatening rain. Alice was there, as well as Maswara, the Lutheran black shirt, and another fellow in complete tribal dress we had seen before. As they sat around the fire, Sitten interrupted their talk and turned to business. "We walked all this way," he said to the Lutheran, "and you won't turn talk for us? We bring two boys to stay with you and preach, but who will turn talk? Who will look out for them?" Silence. Sitten sighed. "If we leave them, will you look out for them, give them food?" "Oh, yes," said the man. The words sounded hollow. Earlier that day, after the Lotu, Sitten had talked at length with Peterson and Oklo, who were supposed to stay in Angati. These boys were nonplussed by the outcome of the Lotu. They were dismayed and worried. How could they stay here and preach? For two 16-year-old boys to be turned loose in a remote village without even an interpreter and with only a thin indication of hospitality? Well, Sitten had told them, "Your mission here will be to learn some of the language. That's all you can do. Forget the preaching for a while. Just try to learn the basics of their speech." To me, the proposition was questionable, to say the least. But then, New Guineans are natural-born linguists. The country has hundreds of different tribal languages, and most natives speak at least two languages, their own and Pidgin. Then they may speak the tongues of other tribes, and on top of that, sometimes English. After a lengthy harangue, Sitten extracted the promises of the men present that night that they would look out for the boys, give them food and shelter. And now to the other business at hand. We planned to leave in the morning, early, before the sun rises. We needed carriers and a guide. Ah, here was a thorny problem. There was between here and Aiwamba an uncrossable river, they said, a raging torrent which kills men. Here was a new one, heretofore unmentioned. This river was now discussed as though it were an insurmountable barrier. Alice's eyes were glowing in a certain sulphurous way as he told us about this man-eating river. "You can't cross it," he said. "It's strong, too much." I felt my stomach beginning to tie itself into knots at this new monster across our path, but Sitten removed the river with a wave of his hand. "I'm not afraid of a river," he said. "We'll make a bridge if we have to. Now we need carriers." At this, Alice's eyes flashed like hot black diamonds. He laughed desperately, contemptuously. "You're not afraid. You're not afraid of the river, eh?" But for Sitten, Alice no longer existed. He did not listen to Alice anymore, nor incline his head in his direction. Sitten was talking to the Lutheran. But the Lutheran seconded the story. "Terrible river, can't be crossed, will kill you." Sitten wanted to know how far it was to Aiwamba. The day before, all had told us one day's march. Now, inexplicably, the distance stretched to two or more full days over Drayapela Mountains with a raging torrent in the middle. As though beating his head against a rock, Sitten went on. "We need carriers, at least two. We really need four. We will pay them. We want to leave before the sun rises." At last, old Maswara and the heretofore silent but evidently friendly man in tribal dress agreed to carry for us at daylight. They would be here before the sun was up, ready to carry our cargo to Aiwamba. With these promises ringing in our ears like the clatter of tin pots, we turned in. Outside, a mountain wind whipped against the thin hut and whirled black clouds like kettles of sludge. In my sleep and in my waking and now in my memory, an image of that night lodged in my mind. It was after our discussion, when bleak depression and discouragement had fallen on us. Here we were, 5 days from the Watut River, and a supposedly impassable river lay ahead of us. I was enraged, both by the thought that such a river might have been there all the time, lying in wait, so to speak, and by the strong suspicion that Alice and the Lutheran were lying to suit their purposes. After all, up until this night, the river had never been mentioned. In fact, when we first arrived at Ngati, natives spoke casually of Aiwamba as being a day's hike away. Now we were assured that it was futile to try for it. How vehement Alice had been when Sitton shrugged off that river. It was in that moment that I perceived that in Alice's scheme of things, Sitton was the enemy. Sitton was his own personal enemy, to be vanquished by every sort of stealth, deception, and intrigue Alice could devise. Where would it stop? Murder? That night, as I watched his eyes glowing, I didn't put it past Alice. But for now, anyway, it didn't fit his purposes. And the Lutheran, what were his motives? Had Alice conferred with him in secret? Probably. But he was not openly hostile, as Alice showed signs of becoming. But the image, it was the old man, Maswara, who that night had removed his purple sweater and wore only the age-old Menyamya attire, a dirty grass loincloth, beaten bark cape, pig tusks through the nose. It was in the night, in the dark, smoky hut, clouds black and whirling outside. The old man, his black chest glistening, the twin tusks downturned in his nostrils after much discussion with his compatriots, had taken out his bamboo Jew's harp and began to play. The Jew's harp is a favorite native instrument made of a single small piece of bamboo with a split tongue. Its sound, in such circumstances, is exceedingly somber, almost subhuman, invoking images of baser reptilian life, croaks, twangs, grunts. It is more an imitation of the dark life of the jungle than it is music. Maswara stared into the fire while he played, his eyes fixed with a dark gleam. The twanging imbued the already grim night with a sense of the weird. I sat silent against the wall, my knees drawn up, looking from one face to the other. There was Alice, his face now a perfectly innocent mask. The Lutheran, utterly blasé and unaffected, a garrulous, self-important fellow, puffing the big bamboo. The other native, who was to carry for us, outfitted in bright yellow woven reeds, scarlet headband, adorned with shells, his face was ingratiating, smiling, devoid of hostility, his teeth were black from buai. Old Maswara had his own expression, and at the time I did not know whether it was angelic or satanic, but for the moment it was enwrapped in the twanging, croaking music. Yes, Maswara and the friendly native had agreed to carry for us in the morning. We were to leave before light, but I felt no real security. I didn't believe in it anymore. They would agree to anything if pressed to it, but would do exactly what their own motives dictated. And now in this night, a dark river of fear had been born, and they were working hard to impress it into us. You cannot go. You cannot leave. You cannot make it to Aiwamba. That was the gist of their message to us. You are stuck here. That was the message I got deep in my guts on this second night, and the old man's music twisted my fears around in a dark cauldron as he gazed oblivious into the flickering fire, his mouth pressed against the slitted strip of bamboo. In the morning, of course, no one was there. We rose in darkness and packed, sensing the futility of our actions. No, there was no one. The old man was gone, as was the other would-be carrier. We shook the timbers in our angry search, berated the Lutheran, blew the gourd horn, shouted messages, but they just weren't around. Alice darted around like an imp, excited by his devilment. "So you are not afraid of the river, eh?" he seemed to say. "Well, you will not even get the chance to challenge it." Sitton and I decided to make the most of what we had, namely the bush airstrip. Maybe we could flag a plane. We went out there carrying our gear and took everything red and orange from our packs. We set to work with the boys, hauling wood down to make 3 signal fires so that if we heard or spotted a plane, we could light them quickly. It should not be difficult, we figured. The day before, I had sat on this airfield, enjoying the view of the mountains and the quiet remoteness of the area, and a plane had flown directly overhead in plain sight. The next time we saw one, we would douse the wood piles with kerosene, light them, and wave our bright orange air mattresses and everything else we could find. The morning passed like that, in a state of twisted anxiety and confusion. On the exposed airfield, it was bitterly hot. The flies were furious, the sun blinding. Way, way off, down toward the east, we occasionally heard the low drone of aircraft, as though there were a regular route here, but none came in sight. I, for one, was confused. What exactly were we doing? We were making a bid for rescue now, but rescue from what? What exactly was the problem? The answer was a dark and subtle secret buried somewhere under layers of deception. This river was a red herring. It threw my scheme of thinking into chaos. It seemingly had been born overnight. Alice knew our plans to go to Aiwamba from the start. Why had he never mentioned any such river? Why wait till the night before we planned to go? What force was holding us on this mountain now? I felt anger and confusion, subtle and unstable as we sat on the mountain in the brilliant glare, the jungle standing big and silent around the edges of the strip like great heaps of barbed wire. I looked over to the southwest in the direction Aiwamba supposedly lay. Massive backs of mountains covered with thickets of jungle, impassable to us without a guide. What about a compass? I wore a compass on my wrist and had kept our general course ever since we left the Watut. So we had come southwest, eh? So perhaps now we should set back down the trail to northeast without food. And then, when we lost the trail just ahead, on into the jungle, guided by my compass, the thought nearly made me laugh. A compass! How do you walk northeast over a sheer 1,000-foot escarpment covered with a mass of jungle so tangled and wretched that even Alice got wrapped up in its vines? We could wander in those mountains till we dropped dead of fatigue, fever, hunger, and fear. We didn't even have a gun. You don't need a gun in New Guinea, my father had told me, but he had never walked to Manyamya. He had never had to abandon his food supply and then found himself stranded in a village of inscrutable, subtly hostile, or were they, natives 5 days from the nearest point of departure. I pondered the puzzle, for now I knew it was a puzzle. We were at the heart of a puzzle, a maze, dead in the center, find your way out. Days earlier, plodding through the jungle, I had thought whimsically of books such as Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, wherein a trip into the deep, dark jungle always ends at some evil source. Well, I had thought that's all right for novels, but we were headed for Ngati, rest, succor, friendship, carriers, guides, Christians. And here we were in the heart of the maze, growing ever darker, new complex channels fanning out in every direction, each one enticing and forbidding, each one a dead end. So we were parked on this strip of grass, set in the middle of a million miles of God's ultimate wilderness. He had made it for people like me, adventurous children, and for people like the Manyamyas, dark, wizened little leprechauns of the jungle whose secrets and mysteries still clung to twisted roots, limbs, caverns, and smoky huts with groaning melodies of the darkest heart. Already I began to salute Joseph Conrad, the Heart of Darkness. By God, the Heart of Darkness. But I really did not know yet what the Heart of Darkness was. We were impatient in our expectation of miracles. By noon, nothing had come over, and we were bitterly disappointed. 5 hours. 5 hours of torment by flies and sun, and not a plane in sight. Only the tantalizing distant drones in that eastern valley from time to time. And I felt a squirming sense of embarrassment. Suppose a pilot came. What would we say? About noon, a pair of natives came out of the jungle. A man with a boy of about 17, as wild and healthy and rugged as any natives I've seen. They were outfitted in the whole garb. Something grabbed at my guts when I noticed around their waists large bones, such as might come from, say, human arms. That these men might be wearing human bones seemed perfectly natural and in keeping with the rest of their appearance, but it did nothing to assuage my tensions about our predicament. I later learned these were cassowary thigh bones which had been smoked and polished. Two of them, attached with a vine cord, were worn as a belt and held up the grass loincloth, clamping the bark case to the buttocks as well. These fellows were outfitted with enormous, elaborate shell necklaces, quinoa shells, woven yellow reeds, brilliant scarlet headbands with shell straps, and bunches of cassowary feathers. Their mouths were packed with buai, and they carried bows and arrows. These were warriors, men, hunters. They exuded an air of glamorous excitement. The younger one was lithe and handsome, his chest a small keg. For some reason, he reminded me of the young shepherd David in the Bible. I could picture him out guarding the flocks, ready to stone wolves, pluck a harp, or slay giants, as the occasion demanded. The older man was less handsome, less confident-looking, but no less robust. His face was screwed up with lurking anxieties. Perhaps he had been let in on certain secrets. Alice took the credit for their arrival. Indeed, that morning he had left early to ferret them out, purportedly to have them carry for us. But I had trouble believing in such purity of motives. Anyway, they agreed to carry for us next morning. A price was set. If I doubted Alice's motives, though, I did not doubt these fellows. They had a certain clarity to their gaze, a certain physical independence, which the shirking Alice and the pompous Lutheran lacked. For no substantial reason, I felt we could depend on them. They said they would carry for us in the morning, and I believed they would. And another thing, it turned out Sitton knew the older man. I didn't recognize you with these clothes on, Sitton joked with him. The man grinned, happy to be remembered. Like some other men, Yam-Yas, he had in times past walked to Lehi and attended the mission there. Sitton had indeed seen him in church. That factor boosted our hopes. Still, we decided if a plane should come, we would take it. There were two or three false alarms. We were overly excitable. At the dimmest buzz of an engine, we would take our places at the wood pile, arranged in a triangle. Me with a kerosene can, Leonard with matches.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com. By phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart. From his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.